This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jetsun Pema, is the younger sister of the Dalai Lama. They're both dedicated to keeping alive Tibetan culture and religion, despite the Chinese occupation, in which over 100,000 Tibetan monks and nuns have been killed or tortured. Jetsun Pema grew up in Tibet and now lives in exile in Dharamsala, India, which is the seat of the Tibetan government in exile. She heads the Tibetan Children's Village, which educates exiled Tibetan children about their culture and religion. She was the first woman minister of the Tibetan government in exile and was awarded the title Mother of Tibet by its National Assembly. Some of her family's story is told in the film 7 Years in Tibet and Kundun, Martin Scorsese's new movie, which opens Christmas Day. Pema tells her own story in her new autobiography. When she was born in 1940, her brother was already recognized as the Dalai Lama. I asked if, as a child, she was expected to behave a certain way in his presence.
You know, His Holiness was already recognized, and he was installed in the Potala. And so, as a child, I always knew that I had a brother who was living up in the Potala.
That's the palace?
That's the palace. It's a, you know, it's up on a hill and it's very impressive. There's over a thousand rooms, and it overlooks the little town of Lhasa. And when you heard your mother saying, oh, you know, His Holiness is living up there, I think it gave you the impression that he was very special. And so whenever we went up those flights of stairs to go and see him, and he had all, you know, his monk attendants around him, and my mother and father would prostrate in front of him. And so we also had to do that. And with all that kind of sort of, you know, ceremony just to go and see him, I think it put a message in my head that he was somebody special and somebody who had to be treated with great respect.
Do you ever think what it was like for your parents to have their baby boy be His Holiness and to have to bow when they saw him?
Well, for any Tibetan family, you know, for a Tibetan parents to have their son recognized as a reincarnate Lama, it's a great privilege and an honor, because Tibetans by nature are very religious, and our religion is very important in our lives. It's not just religion as such, but it's become a way of life for the Tibetans. So when you have a reincarnate Lama as your son, I think parents are really awed by that, and they are they feel that it's an honor, and they pay great respect to their incarnate, reincarnate Lama's son.
You were born about 9 years before China invaded Tibet, and the way of life in Tibet was changed. Would you share with us some of your memories of life in Tibet before the Chinese invasion? Just about what day-to-day life was like for you.
Well, for me, being born after His Holiness was recognized, you know, we had all those special privileges. My parents came from a little village in eastern Tibet. They were, you know, just farmers. And all of a sudden, the Dalai Lama is discovered in their family. And then they were brought to Lhasa, to the capital of Tibet. And there they were given whatever they needed. And they were, you know, a big new house was built for them. And I grew up in this, you know, I was born after His 1 year later, and I grew up with my sister's children, a boy and a girl. And then many of our servants, they had their children, and we had a wonderful time. So my memories of Tibet was always very happy memories, where we had just wonderful times, and, you know, playing with my nephew and niece and the children of the servants, then going to school to learn to read and write Tibetan, and also, you know, visiting the various monasteries and enjoying the various festivals that were celebrated in the city of Lhasa. So I think I just have just wonderful memories of Tibet.
What do you think your parents expected that your life would be like when you grew up, before the invasion?
Well, if the Chinese didn't come to Tibet, and you know, then I think I might have stayed on in Lhasa and just got a Tibetan education and stayed on. But then because the Chinese entered Tibet at the end of 1949, then my sister, my older sister, she was also not feeling well, and my mother decided that we should accompany her to India and to remain in India to get an education. And along with me, my sister's two children, they also came. And so the three of us, we were sent with my sister to India to study.
So you were sent to India for your education as a girl. And I believe you were educated in a Catholic convent. What was it like for you as a Buddhist, as the sister of the Dalai Lama, to have a rigorous Catholic education? Did the nuns expect you to forsake Buddhism for Catholicism?
Oh, well, the education, you know, I was sent to a convent school because these convent schools in India are recognized to be the best schools for girls in India in those days. And then also the nuns, they were very kind and, you know, they were really good educationalists. Most of the girls in the school were either, you know, Hindus or Muslims or Buddhists, and they were not really, I think only about 10 or 15% were Catholics. The nuns were all, they, you know, understood our background and they didn't sort of really try to convert us. And for me, I already, you know, even at the age of 10, I already knew my own sort of roots, and I knew I was Buddhist, and I don't think I could change my religion, even at that age.
My guest is Jetsun Pema, the younger sister of the Dalai Lama. She's written a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jetsun Pema. She's the sister of the Dalai Lama and president of the Tibetan Children's Village, which oversees the resettlement and education of Tibetan children in exile. And she's written a new book called Tibet, My Story. Your brother, the Dalai Lama, fled Tibet in 1959 and resettled in Dharamsala, which has become the kind of like Tibet in exile. Were you living in Dharamsala at the time?
No, I was still when in 1959, when His Holiness, you know, after the Tibetans had the uprising against the Chinese, he had to leave Tibet and seek asylum in India. And at that time, it was my almost the final year of my schooling. So when he arrived, I was in school. Then later, I joined him in Mussoorie in one of the hill stations where the Indian government had provided him with accommodation, and he was staying there. And in 1960, from Mussoorie, then he moved to Dharamsala. And in 1960, when I finished my school, then I went to Dharamsala and spent a couple of months there helping my sister with the work that she had, she was doing in looking after the Tibetan refugee children.
Your sister died in 1964 and you took over her work overseeing
That's right.
the education and resettlement of Tibetan children living in exile in India. What was it like for you when you started doing this work, watching children refugees come to India often with no parents, either because their parents were killed or because their parents had to stay behind?
Yes, it was in the beginning. It was really a very difficult situation for the children, as well as for those of you know, like my sister and all those ladies who were looking after the children, because then in the beginning they didn't have proper food, clothing, shelter, and everybody was coming. You know, the refugees were pouring into India from Tibet, and so many children were, you know, had skin infections, and they had stomach ailments. And those earlier years of the refugees, it was really a terrible situation. And many children lost their lives, and even many adults, you know, they lost their lives because they were not used to the climate in India. And also, they had to take long journeys across the mountainous regions to get into India, so it was a very difficult time.
What kind of schooling have you tried to give the children in India, and how does it compare to the schooling that they would have received before the invasion in Tibet?
Well, today in exile, 99% of Tibetan children receive education, and it's a modern education. They learn since 1986, we have switched, you know, from English to Tibetan language as the medium of instruction up to the primary school level. Then from primary school level onwards, then the medium of instruction is in English. And they get a very strong foundation in their own, mother tongue. And then also the education is an education which is recognized by the Indian Central Board of Secondary Education, because unless we give our children an education which is recognized in the country, it would be very difficult for our children to pursue their further education in the various training centers and, you know, in the colleges and in the universities within India. But then at the same time, what we are also emphasizing is that His Holiness always says, you must have a good education, but at the same time, in the end, you must be a good human being. So we want to give our children a value-oriented education so that these young people who finish their schools and go for further education and all, they should be good human beings and also good Tibetans.
Some of the children have come to you as teenagers, and they have grown up in post-invasion Tibet. And I know you've had some trouble with these older teenagers who have come to Tibet. You write in your book that there's been some gang fighting and rock throwing, and it was very difficult to figure out how to deal with these problems. Would you tell us a little bit about what you tried?
Yes, these are a special group of young people who are now coming in quite large numbers, you know, escaping into exile. And these young people, most of them have never had any kind of formal education, and they have gone through a lot of hardship, and they've seen terrible things, like they've seen their, you know, parents being sort of tortured in front of them, and they've seen their whole family disrupted because of the situation being what it is in Tibet. And then now when they came into exile, you know, they were not able to tackle with the freedom that we enjoy. You know, they couldn't believe that they could just get enough to eat every day, and that, you know, they got clothing, and, you know, we tried to look after them as best as we could. But then at the same time, they had so much of anger and hatred in them. So, you know, we felt that they were very aggressive, and they were impolite. And so we discussed together how we should look after these young people. And the first thing that was to make them feel that all of us, and also the school facilities and whatever we had, that it was for them, that we cared for them, that we wanted to look after them. And, you know, like sometimes they would play football or volleyball, and they would kick the balls, and in one day the two or three, you know, footballs were going. And we always said, doesn't matter, let them, you know, sort of bring out their anger on the balls and on the field playing and all. And then later, it's surprising how they changed. In a couple of months, their whole attitude changed, and the expressions on their face changed. And it was just through letting them know that we cared for them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jetsun Pema. She's the sister of the Dalai Lama, and she's the president of the Tibetan Children's Village, which oversees the resettlement and education of Tibetan children in exile in India. She's also written a new book called Tibet, My Story. You write that, ironically, exile has enabled the women of Tibet to evolve, to be liberated from the taboos which had previously confined them in Tibet. What are some of the taboos and restrictions that Tibetan women faced that you think they're getting out of now living in exile?
Well, in Tibet, in the old Tibet, Tibetan women didn't take any part in politics. And they didn't do any kind of, you know, like in the government service and all, you didn't see any kind of, any women. But then, because of the occupation of Tibet by China and the brutality that the, you know, we saw over there, and I think the women, they really felt this very much, especially, you know, when they saw their sons and husbands being, you know, so ill-treated, and they, many of them lost their, you know, sons and husbands. Then the Tibetan women, like when we had the uprising on the 10th of March, it was the women of Lhasa who were the ones who instigated, you know, all the people to come and, you know, try to protect His Holiness. And that's the time when the women really sort of stood up and they united, you know, together. And then now in exile, Tibetan women, they get equal kind of education with the boys, and Tibetan women are now, you know, involved in politics. And now today, like the Tibetan government, you know, we have a democratic system of government. The members of the parliament in exile, they are selected, you know, they are voted by the people. And there are 46 members of parliament, and of that, 12 are women, which means more than almost 35% are women. So the Tibetan women are really coming forward, and, you know, they're doing very well.
I should point out that you are the Minister of Education.
I was, not anymore now.
Former.
I resigned.
Okay.
Yes, that's
okay.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And is your daughter elected to the parliament?
Yes, yes. She's serving her second term, uh-huh. And yes, she's enjoying it.
What do you miss most geographically about your country?
Oh, I'm the mountains and the lakes and the, you know, the clear blue sky and the fresh air. Unpolluted air, yes.
Describe what the mountains look like.
The mountains?
Yeah.
Well, they look very high and, you know, magnificent. And it's always, you always have these mountains which are snow-covered very high up. And then you have these kind of, you know, wonderful grassland with lots of the yak and the sheep and all. And then it's all green, and you have a beautiful river sort of flowing through this large stretch of green grassland. And then far away you see the mountain peaks.
Your brother, the Dalai Lama, sent you back to Tibet in 1980 on a kind of fact-finding mission to see what life was like there. And one of the things you discovered was that your parents' old house was now an inn for Chinese military officers. That must have been quite startling.
Yes, it was quite startling. But then what was most startling is that, you know, you see Lhasa, if you go up the Potala and you see, look down into the city, you don't see any more of the Tibetan houses. It's full of army sort of barracks, and you have these horrible looking sort of buildings, you know, 4 or 5 stories high with tin sheet roofs, and it's terrible.
I know you have a small part in the movie 7 Years in Tibet, and in fact you play the role of your mother, the Dalai Lama's mother.
Yes.
And in the movie Kundun, which is about the young Dalai Lama, the movie made by Martin Scorsese that's opening later this year, your daughter plays the role, one of your daughters plays the role of your mother.
That's right.
What did the Dalai Lama have to say about you and your daughter being involved in these movies?
Oh, well, he approved of it, you know, because we told him about these movies and he approved of that, yes. And also my children and my brothers, my other brothers, they all felt that they couldn't see our mother being portrayed by somebody else. So they told myself and my daughter to go ahead and do play the role of, you know, our mother in the two movies.
My guest is Jetsun Pema, the younger sister of the Dalai Lama. She's written a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jetsun Pema. She's the sister of the Dalai Lama and president of the Tibetan Children's Village, which oversees the resettlement and education of destitute Tibetan children in exile who have come to India. At the end of your book, Tibet, My Story, you write, "Today I am alive, but who knows what may happen tomorrow. Throughout my adult life, death has been present. I'm conscious that life is not eternal and that one must think about one's own impermanence." How does Buddhism teach you to think about your own death?
Well, Buddhism always, teaches us that of impermanence. So, you know, death is always something which we think about. And then also, you see, when you think of that, you always, I always feel that you should be prepared for it. Prepared in the sense that, you know, because we believe in reincarnation and life after, you know, in the next life. So we feel that, at least I feel that it's very important that you lead a good life so that, you know, you're prepared for the next life. And also when your death is sort of close by, that, you know, you can say to yourself that my life was meaningful. And that, I think, when you think of impermanence, then you always want to do something purposeful with your life.
In your book, you write a little bit about how Buddhism has helped you cope with watching your people suffer. And you write that Buddhism teaches that some people suffer more, others less, and that the degree of difficulty we experience is determined by the acts of our previous existence. We therefore live according to our karma. The thing is, though, if you look at it that way, it means that Tibetans are in a way responsible for their own suffering. A more political analysis would say, no, the Chinese government is responsible for the suffering. It's not about what the Tibetans did in their previous lives. It's about the oppression of the Chinese government.
Well, you know, we believe that in karma, that's your sort of, you know, one's fate or whatever one did in the last life, that it has an effect on this life. So, like what happened to our country, it's a kind of a collective karma of our people. And somewhere along the line, maybe, you know, we did some things which were not good, and now sort of we have to live through that. But then at the same time, you know, one's karma always can't be bad. So maybe I hope the soon, you know, the positive side will also come, and that it'll be easier for the Tibetans in the, you know, in the years to come.
But you know what I mean? If you just look at it as karma, then the Chinese who are ruling Tibet now, you'd think, well, they're doing well, so they must have been good in previous lives, and the Tibetans who are suffering, well, they must have done something bad in previous lives. And it doesn't seem in a way like a very fair way of politically analyzing the situation.
Yes. But then it's not as simple as that. It's quite, you know, when you think of karma and how it affects your life and, you know, all that, it's quite sort of complicated. And but yet, I think if you try to analyze it and, you know, Tibetans, we, you know, we always say we try to make our life simple. And I think that in that respect, we are quite lucky in the sense that, you know, Tibetan attitude is that what is the past, it's, you know, it's gone, and tomorrow will take care of itself, and let's make the best of the present. That's the kind of Tibetan attitude. So we don't make things too complicated, I think, you know.
Your life has been taken over with the mission of caring for and educating Tibetan children in exile in India. Do you have any sense of what your adult life would have been like had Tibet not been invaded by the Chinese, had you not had to take on this difficult mission of educating children in exile?
I think it would not be as interesting and as worthwhile as it is now.
I guess that's kind of ironic.
Yes. Yes. So maybe I have a, you know, for making my life more meaningful, maybe I have to be grateful to the Chinese.
One last question. How often do you see your brother, the Dalai Lama?
Oh, well, whenever I have some problems, I can always go and see him. But then he's always so busy and traveling around. So unless I really have to see him, I don't sort of bother him. But then on his birthday and on special occasions, you know, he invites my brother, my younger brother and myself, and if some of our older brothers, if they're there, then we have a meal together. And so I see him quite a few times in a year.
Jetsun Pema, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jetsun Pema's new autobiography is called Tibet, My Story.